This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a veteran of Occupy Wall Street says the Democratic Party is trying its best to co-opt the movement. The first of a series of stop-and-frisk trials concludes in New York. And if the International Criminal Court is so serious about crimes against humanity, why aren't any white leaders being indicted?
But first, a slew of states have enacted laws requiring people on public assistance to undergo drug testing, laws that may not pass constitutional muster. Data gathered by the state of Florida show that its law failed to save the state money or reduce the number of people qualifying for welfare. In Atlanta, the Southern Center for Human Rights is preparing a legal challenge to welfare drug testing. Sarah Totanchi, the center's executive director, says drug testing is part of a cynical war against the poor.
What we see with political legislation like this is that the reasons that are put forth by the proponents of drug testing poor people who are seeking public benefits is that it really actually has nothing to do with trying to limit state spending on people who abuse drugs. And it has everything to do with an ongoing war on poor people in this country.
And I suppose since it really doesn't have anything to do with savings, a study that shows that there are no savings still won't shut them up.
That's correct. I mean, when Georgia was considering this legislation in this past General Assembly, we suggested to them if they were concerned about state benefits being used by people who use drugs, that they would have much higher impact if they were to, say, drug test every college student who's benefiting from our state-sponsored HOPE scholarship program. Or perhaps they should drug test every person that works for the state or every elected official. Those individuals consume far more of our state resources than people who receive TANF benefits for a limited period of time do.
In fact, welfare, public assistance, these have become, long ago became, code words for race.
That's exactly right. And we are here in the Deep South, and the continued attacks on communities of color have waged over the years. We have one of the largest prison systems per capita in the country here in Georgia. 1 in 32 adults nationwide is under some form of correctional supervision. Here in Georgia, it's 1 in 13. We're more than twice the national rate. And all of this is part of an ongoing attack on communities of color.
And so this is as much propaganda as it is legislation, since the costs even will not be affected. Unless, of course, they can scare everybody from applying for any kind of assistance whatsoever.
That's right. I mean, this sort of legislation is what we see. We call it typical red meat legislation during an election year. 2 years ago, during our last election cycle, the target was immigrants. So whether it's attacking brown folks or attacking black folks, Georgia politicians know that a way to win elections is by throwing out this kind of red meat rhetoric-filled legislation.
Now, it appears that the idea of just having a blanket compulsion for people applying for public assistance to take drug tests may not be faring too well constitutionally, but states are finding ways around that, aren't they?
That is my understanding. Here in Georgia, the law that was passed has very serious constitutional problems in that it is a blanket test of any person who is seeking to receive public benefits. Said the Constitution has been upheld in a way to show that this is just not okay. We just can't go in and demand any citizen, for no other reason than that they are poor, give a sample from their body to be tested for drugs. This is called suspicionless drug testing, and the courts, both locally and at the national level, have found it to be unconstitutional. So if Georgia actually goes forward in trying to implement this law, we are confident that a court will stop it.
And that will cost the states a lot of money to defend it, won't it?
It sure will. It sure will. And that's one of the things that our office, the Southern Center for Human Rights, is trying to remind the Georgia Attorney General, is that the law is on our side, and going forward with this legislation would be a costly legal battle for the state of Georgia. And is that truly the right way to spend our taxpayer dollars? A family of three receives a maximum of $268 a month here in Georgia, and there's a maximum of receiving TANF of 48 months in a lifetime. This is a very small amount of money that we're talking about, and we're talking about families and children. And for our legislators to be going after some of our poorest mothers and children in our state is just downright mean, and it's downright wrong.
And yet, when they mount attacks like this, it does cost you resources to defend against them instead of doing the kind of work I'm sure you'd like to do, which is greatly expand the kind of social safety net that people need to lead dignified lives.
That is so true. We are constantly trying to recommend that we take measures to provide, whether it's preventative care or treatment in the community or resources or options for folks so that they don't have to go down the wrong path or make difficult decisions or whatever the case may be. But Georgia legislature has decided to go down this route of creating even more problems for folks who are in a rough place, and we will fight it.
Sarah Tutanchi of the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta.
A New York City judge convicted 20 activists of disorderly conduct after a five-day trial. The defendants, including noted Professor Cornel West and Black Agenda's own Nellie Bailey, were arrested while protesting the city's infamous stop-and-frisk policies at a police precinct in Harlem last October. Nellie Bailey of Occupy Harlem was the first to speak at a press conference outside the courthouse.
This is a city in which the mayor, our billionaire mayor, is talking about austerity with cuts to schools and hospitals and social service agencies, but yet this city found the money to conduct a five-day trial and all of the expenses that entail. Certainly, there was no austerity given with respect to this court proceeding. So we know from that and other factors as well that this was a political showcase. It was a political trial in which not only stop and frisk was on trial, but most importantly, our First Amendment rights, the freedom of speech, the right to assemble, and what constitutes disorderly conduct. Whether or not the police can arbitrarily rule from its point of view outside of the legal framework what is disorderly conduct. We all believe that they did not prove their case. It was a weak case, which buttresses our point that this was, in fact, a political showcase. This is Mayor Bloomberg telling not only us, but other defendants in the future, because this issue will not go away. But most importantly, it's a message to OWS. We are racking up the bar here. We're up in the ante here because we're going to get you. And this case, it's important because we know we have cases coming out of Brooklyn, and we know we have another case coming out of the Bronx. And they want to be able to point to the ruling in this case, supposedly based on law or the interpretation of law, that in fact we were guilty of disorderly conduct and obstructing the passageway of pedestrians on the sidewalk, which is just ridiculous. But for us, this is only the start of the battle.
Stephen Phelps, interim senior minister, Riverside Church. Men, mostly men of color, are being violated. If you translate that word into French, you would hear being raped. Stop and frisk is a kind of rape, the threat to be stopped and frisked is a kind of terrorism. It works exactly the same as terrorism works. That is to say, to create a spirit of fear throughout an entire population in order to gain a political objective. The whole question of the American experiment hangs on our ability to experience our unity in some ways, even though there's a great deal of inequality. And so we're severely troubled by the actions of the city in continuing this policy. And our conviction today, while it does not signal any change on the part of the city, it has certainly raised the consciousness of many more people. It is extremely difficult to change people's hearts and minds, and we need this continuing pressure to bring the word to more and more people. I believe that a change in an evil practice like this can become the beginning of changing not only evils all through the criminal system, but could actually become the shifting of the mind for change in all kinds of expressions of the capitalist engine that is oppressing so very many. I put my energies mostly into changing the criminal policies, I should say, the methods of criminalizing people in our country. Many of my friends put their energies into global warming, into food justice, and I have no quibble with how a person decides to put his or her energies. But I believe this one has the capability of moving us all so we really begin to feel our way toward the question of how all can be served better. Thank you.
First thing I want to say is let's have the co-issuers of this call come up here. Cornel West and myself, we were the ones that issued this call for a campaign of civil disobedience to stop, stop, and frisk.
Carl Dix, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
And let's be very clear, this was a very high-stakes battle. We targeted a policy that is pretty foundational to the way that they keep things under control here in New York City. Criminalizing black and Latino youth, treating them like they're guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. And we targeted that on purpose because we know how foul it is. When you look at that racial profiling that Stop and Frisk is, together with the 2.4 million people warehoused in prison, the torture-like conditions in prison, together with the way they treat people even after they serve their sentences, you got a condition of a slow genocide that could easily become a fast one. Mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. We had to break that silence. We did that. We did that on October 21st. We continued it. We carried it into the courtroom. Now, they didn't especially like what we did in the courtroom. They didn't like any of that. But I saw some folks who were saying, it don't matter what you think of it, we know it's right. People said that as the judge was about to give them the sentence. You know, so they ain't backing away. Nobody said, don't worry, judge, I ain't going to do this no more. Cut me some slack. Everybody who stood up said, we were right to do what we did. We're going to keep on doing it. And that is very, very important, sisters and brothers. And we got to mean that and act on it. Because, look, they're still stopping and frisking people. They're still going down. They're still going down like that. We got to go to people and say, we need to hear your stories. We need to let everybody know your stories so that they can see the injustices being perpetrated in their name and we can challenge them to get involved. In about a month, it will be 100 days since Trayvon Martin was murdered. We got to do another hoodie day. We got to say we are all Trayvon, because if you really understand it, we all are. Black people, Latino people are all Trayvon because the same racial profiling that stole that brother's life has stolen too many lives of young black and Latino men and women, because Ayanna Stanley Jones's life was stolen by the police in Detroit. But even if you are white and you know that you're not going to get hit that way, could you stand to live in a world where you know that kind of abuse, that kind of brutality, that kind of murder comes down solely because of the color of somebody's skin? And I submit to you that if you got an ounce of justice in your heart, you should want to refuse to live in that kind of world. So in that sense, we're all Trayvon Martin, and we got to show that on June 5th. We got to make that move. Now I'm going to give you my co-issuer, the man who is getting me in more trouble.
First, I do want to acknowledge my dear brother Carl Dix, long-distance runner. And I don't want to take that for granted. It's very difficult to stay on the course and not sell out, to stay on the course and not give up. So that's what we do. We emerge from this moment with more strength, more fortitude, and more determination, because it ain't about us. We just simply try to make a contribution to minimize the suffering of these precious young people out here. And we let them know that we love them, we care for them, and we let the powers that be know we're going to stand with them. We're going to fight back. We're going to defend them. We're going to protect them. And we're going to correct them. They need some consciousness raising, too. Oh, yes, indeed. But for the 20 who held on all these months, you come out more empowered, more ready to fight. And keep in mind, you got some ancestors in the past who now smiling on you in such a way. Paul Robeson said, no, you haven't forgot me. Du Bois say, you haven't forgot me. Ella Baker say, you haven't forgot me. Malcolm X say, you haven't forgot me. Brother Martin say, you haven't forgot me. Brother Huey and Bobby, oh, you haven't forgot me. That's just on the chocolate side. We ain't got to the vanilla side yet, because we got white brothers and sisters who part of this, and brown, and yellow, and red. So it's a compliment to be guilty today. It's a tribute to be guilty today, but also to keep in mind the focus is on the suffering that we are concerned about. 1900 today, already. You see what I mean? So thank you all so much, and stay strong.
All right. First, I just want to say thank God we're here today.
Reverend Earl Cooper Camp, rector of St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Harlem.
On October 21st, in love, in truth, we're seeking justice for all of God's children here in New York City to stop this racist, this immoral policy, to stop it for us. And we got the voice out real good in Harlem up at the 28th precinct. And then we've been hearing it in Brooklyn, in the Bronx, throughout this city. Today, this week, Staten Island, that's right, Staten Island, Queens, all over the city. But thank God, because what we've been doing with these incredible 20 defendants, with Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with Cornel West of Princeton University, soon to be at Union Seminary, coming together and making this call. We're hearing about stop and frisk all around this country, all around the world. Right. What happened today does indeed make us stronger, because now it's time to continue this work. We stand in a long heritage that Dr. West talked about, but we got a future ahead of us for those young people, a future of justice, a future of freedom, a future of love. And that's what's so powerful about what has been accomplished here today, but especially by the young people. At one point, we were referred to on the front bench as the old gray heads. And then we knew that we were backed by a lot of young people, too. We should hear their voices now, because that's where stop and frisk is going to really take root for justice, for truth, and for love. So thank you all very much, and God bless you. Thank you.
My name is John Hector. I was involved in a trial found guilty. I want to use a word that was used in a courtroom. It's called tradition. We're following a long tradition of civil disobedience. Martin Luther King and others that have come before us and have done the same things that we're trying to do. But it's also, in one sense, a bad word, because it's a tradition. It wouldn't be a tradition if we solved the problems in the first place that are plaguing our communities. I'm one of the 1,900 young black men that are being stopped in the city every single day.
Tell it, brother.
You know, and it's outrageous that we live in a society where, under the guise of crime and punishment, young black men can be stopped and young Latino men can be stopped for any reason at all and be searched and frisked and basically raped in the street and have no kind of recourse, no kind of way to speak out about it. But here today, we're here to speak about it and speak. And I'm speaking for all of those young men out there, those young black and Latino men out there that are getting stopped and frisked every day that have nothing to say, that can say nothing about it. I'm the one that is stepping up and saying something about it. I've been stopped and frisked. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran. I know that's supposed to be held to some high regard in this society, but obviously, if you're a black U.S. Navy veteran, it's held to no regard in this society. It doesn't matter. You can be stopped and frisked and treated like everybody else. And we need to do something that finally changed this whole situation, because it's an outrage. Yeah, I'm guilty. If you want to say I'm guilty of stepping up for justice, yes, I am.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Oh, oh, oh.
Yeah, how everybody doing? My name is Jose LaSalle. Basically, before October 21st, I didn't even know that I was a victim of Stop, Stop, and Frisk until I ran into a paper that Cornel West issued out, a paper calling people to come and gather together in this rally on 125th Street. What really attracted me about that paper was not just about Stop and Frisk, but that Cornel West was going to be there. So in my mind, I said, maybe if I go to this rally, I'll be able to get a picture with Cornel West. So I went to the rally, and as I kept getting closer to Cornel West, before you know it, I was in the 28th precinct, and then before you know it, I was locked up. But the good thing about the whole situation is that I did get that great picture that I was trying to get with Cornel West. But you know what I'm saying? So, you know, but in seriousness, this is something that I've been facing since I was a child.
Yeah.
To a point where it became normal to me. To a point where I started feeling like this was part of my culture. This is part of something that a Puerto Rican kid living here in New York City and Harlem, in East Harlem, is something that we need, something that we're going to go through. Something that is supposed to happen. I had no idea that I could stand up against something like this. You know what I'm saying? Until October 21st. Yeah. But now, I'll tell you one thing, that my eyes has been open.
Yeah.
And now that I see things clearly for what they are and not what they present themselves to be, there is no way in any part of the four corners of this earth that I would not continue to be active, continue to fight for justice, right? Not just for the colored people, for justice for all that's being oppressed by this imperialist government system that we live under. Yeah. And believe me, I feel so energized that I'm ready to do it right now where I'm standing at. That's how energized I am. You know what I'm saying?
Randy Credico, I just wanted to say that while we were here all 5 days, what we saw constantly, and what really is depressing, is so many young black and Latino young children being escorted in handcuffs the whole week on minor pot charges, traffic violations, whatever, all small crimes, being escorted in by stop and frisk units. These big, burly white guys from Long Island, you know, who don't belong in this community. They're more like these slave catchers back in the 1850s that used to go to Pennsylvania and grab innocent, free black men and bring them back into Virginia and North Carolina as slaves. That's all these guys are. You see it all day long, and it's scary. It really is scary. Most of these guys are on steroids. I know this because David Soares, the district attorney of Albany County, told me that during an investigation of an online steroids distributor, he found 600 New York police officers were subscribing to this online pharmacy for steroids. I said, what did you do about it? He said, I kicked it down south to Joe Hines and to this office here. That was 4 years ago. They've done nothing about it. So these guys are on drugs. They're out there. Many of them are just plain out racist, dragging black kids into this criminal justice system. This is just a modern slave auction block. That's all this is.
My name is Jamel Mims, and I was convicted guilty of disorderly conduct. I do not concede that I broke any law. I do not concede that I went out of my way to alarm anyone. I only concede that I went out and that there is a serious difference between going out to cause an alarm and going out to sound the alarm. Mm-hmm. We're talking about an emergency situation.
That's right. That's
where
right.
Thousands of black and Latino youth every day are swept up into the bowels of the criminal justice system, where you see more than 2.4 million people locked away in warehouses and cages across the nation, where you have the rights of people who are held in torture-like conditions. After they've served their sentence to people, when they're released, they are still denied rights like housing and voting, basic rights for the rest of their lives. We're talking about a situation that criminalizes vast sections of youth, that makes it possible for 600,000 completely innocent, or 90% of 600,000 complete black and Latino youth to be targeted by a policy that deliberately criminalizes them for behavioral characteristics. We're dealing with a situation where the youth have been criminalized. We're not talking about criminals. We're not talking about criminal justice. We're talking about a system that criminalizes people for the goal of injustice and social control. What we have to do is to continue this fight. And when we walked into the courtroom Monday morning, and after we testified on Wednesday and Thursday and went through this beautiful, cathartic, diverse experience, these million, or, you know, part and parcel of these millions of voices who have been touched by the system of mass incarceration and speaking out against it.
Yeah.
When we came into that courtroom, I thought, it is not certain that we'll win. But there is no way that we can lose. There's no way that we can lose.
Yeah, hi, I'm Elaine Brower. I'm from Staten Island, the county of Richmond. And I like to think that because of my background, I've never been stopped and frisked, but I stand in solidarity with my brothers and sisters, not only here in New York, but all over, who not even walk out of their doorway to smoke a cigarette or sit down and have a conversation if they're black or brown or yellow, and without being stopped and harassed by the NYPD or now Homeland Security or the FBI or the CIA or any of those acronyms out there that decide that because you're a certain color, you cannot be walking around the streets of this city. And I find that a grave injustice, a terrible thing, not only a violation of civil rights, of human rights, not only a violation of the Constitution, but it's just immoral. How does one live with oneself when you are just stopping people on the street for doing absolutely nothing? I think that, and I have to tell you, as you heard, my husband's a retired NYPD lieutenant. My son did 3 combat tours as a Marine, joined the force in 2004. I have an older son that's on the force. My brother was on the force. And I have to tell you that when I have this conversation with them, they agree that stop and frisk is a policy that they do not agree with because it makes them do things they don't want to do in the first place. But they are forced to do it. Some of them enjoy doing it. Some of them like harassing young black men. Some of them don't like the black men that walk down the street in a certain way. But I think that it's up to us to make sure that Commissioner Kelly and this Mayor Bloomberg, who's really a king, Bloomberg, need to not only stop this policy now, but we have to make sure that when they're out of office, that the next people that come in, we tell them no. We're going to ask them up front, are you going to cancel this policy of stop and frisk? We need to go back to community policing where they are on our side, not the side of the 1% or the bankers or the corporations or the empire that we live in.
My name is Sade Adona. I'm here with Stop, Stop, and Frisk. I joined them on October 21st, and if I'm found condemned guilty by the court for standing up for something that I believe in, then I will go ahead and I will take that charge along with my peers.
All right.
We have been conditioned and institutionalized in this country to believe that we're guilty for something, for a right to stand up to. And I don't believe that until we decide to unite together and merge our energy into one, standing up for the things that we believe in and standing up against any kind of oppression, that we have a chance to change this world into what we want it to be. So I'm grateful to have shared the trial and the stand with many amazing people, many people who are on their way to becoming like future leaders, to people who are our leaders right now, who are letting us stand on their shoulders and leading a way for us. We are creating an alternative way to live the way that we should have been living in the first place. Like, stripping ourselves of that institution, stripping ourselves of the conditioning that we are facing, stripping ourselves of the suppression. And I'm glad that everybody here has so much passion to put themselves on the line and sacrificing their bodies, if that's what they want to call it, for expressing their dissent for something.
Sojourner Truth right here.
Members of Stop, Stop, and Frisk after their disorderly conduct convictions in New York.
The Occupy Wall Street movement is credited with having changed the American political conversation with its focus on the divide between the upper 1% and the rest of us. But a study by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting shows that the corporate media quickly abandoned use of terms like income inequality and corporate greed after the initial excitement of the Occupy movement's demonstrations. John Neffel reported on the study's results for FAIR's publication Extra.
What the study shows is that prior to Occupy, phrases like income inequality and corporate greed were completely absent from the corporate media. And in October, when coverage of Occupy Wall Street spiked, mentions of income inequality and corporate greed spiked as well. But as the attention has sort of drifted away from Occupy, so too has the attention drifted away from the issues that Occupy seeks to highlight.
So does that mean that the corporate media, who also have eyes and ears like everyone else and should be able to see the effects of income inequality for themselves, that corporate media will only deal with the subject, or at least the phrase, if somebody else, like Occupy, brings it up?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it shows. They have no incentive to talk about income inequality or corporate malfeasance or anything like that, because, for one thing, they are corporations and it just doesn't interest them. Also, the people who are most likely to be affected by these policies are the least likely to have lobbyists to advocate on their behalf. But even more significantly, income inequality, in the way that traditional journalists and editors see news, income inequality is not news. It's just the sort of given. It's the baseline, and it becomes invisible to the sort of corporate elites who are in control of the media. And so unless there's some sort of novelty involved, there has to be something new and different. Otherwise, these issues will continue to be invisible to them.
Income inequality is like dog bites man rather than man bites dog, which is news.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that what the study showed, which I was not too surprised to see, is that these trends really are the same across the board. Of the big four newspapers, which is the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and the LA Times, you see essentially the same trends of a spike in October, and then due to Obama's State of the Union speech, which focused explicitly on income inequality, you see some more talk about it in January. But other than that, you really see a very sharp decline, and the decline is even sharper for corporate greed. After October, there's virtually no mention of that phrase in any popular media, and this is including the supposedly liberal media outlets like NPR and MSNBC, whose coverage is, in this particular case, almost indistinguishable from something like CNN or The Times.
And that was the question that I was going to ask. In that narrow little world of the corporate media, doesn't MSNBC, which some consider to be on the left, distinguish itself from Fox, which people consider to be on the right?
I think that they try to distinguish themselves, but only in the way as they root for a different team. And when the two accepted sides of American discourse, which is the Democrats and the Republicans, essentially agree on an issue, that issue becomes invisible. And in Obama's recent response to the Paul Ryan budget, he actually touted, he was happy to say that he hadn't created any new programs for the poor. So honestly, addressing income inequality is not something that the Democrats are capable of doing or interested in doing. And so it becomes completely invisible, and supposedly liberal outlets like MSNBC are uninterested in it unless someone is forcing their hand.
And as many have said, the corporate media's job is to create a consensus in line with corporate interests.
Exactly. And I think that one of the lasting sort of rhetorical gains of Occupy is going to be this framing of the 99% and the 1%. The danger is that the creation of this idea of the 1% is just sort of molded into this media consensus. And they say, well, the 1% is a useful phrase to talk about the super rich. But if it becomes repeated uncritically and removed from the corollary, which is the 99% who are not benefiting from the economy, then it is actually molded into the corporate consensus quite easily. And I think that what the takeaway from that is that there has to be some sort of large-scale protest movement like Occupy, continually changing, continually adapting, and continually presenting itself in some way as news to these journalists and editors who have every incentive to ignore it.
Because phrase-mongering is a game that corporations play very well.
Yeah, yeah. They're great at making slogans, and they're great at making slogans that even mean something cease to mean something. It's really an amazing power of capitalism to rip all meaning from a slogan that actually does have meaning, but they divorce it and just repeat it ad infinitum.
Such as the Reagan Revolution.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The Reagan Revolution, or even Martin Luther King is reduced to I Have a Dream, and all of the incredibly critical elements of his legacy are removed from him, and even intelligent people are just taught this one phrase over and over again.
That was John Neffel of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting in New York City.
Everybody and his mother seems to be claiming to represent the 99% these days, but many of them are actually working on behalf of the Democratic Party. Arun Gupta is a co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal and covers the Occupy movement for Salon Magazine. He says co-optation by the Democrats is a clear and present danger to the Occupy movement.
From literally dozens of discussions I had, there's a variety of perspectives, and I think what's going on is that unions and liberal groups definitely saw something very important in Occupy, and unions, especially early on, gave a lot of support to the Occupy movement, and I think a lot of that is genuine, wanting to support it, because it was a breakthrough. I talked to union organizers across the country who were just marveling about how saying that this has changed the terms of the debate in a way that unions have been struggling to for decades. But with the occupations now having pretty much all been ended, the unions and liberal groups don't see the need to go to the left as much anymore, right? The left doesn't have this independent base of power that essentially the Democratic Party establishment had to appeal to. So at this point, what's going on, is my argument, is a very sophisticated strategy to shunt a lot of this energy into the 2012 elections. And some of the people I talked to, I think they had a good nuance. It's just like, look, it's not, you know, about whether they're allies or adversaries. It's both. That, first of all, who are you talking about? You know, if you're talking about the leadership, I think that's highly problematic. And it's also, it goes against the spirit and intent of Occupy Wall Street, that it does present itself as a leaderless movement. It is about radical participatory democracy. Whether that's completely feasible, though, is a different question. But nonetheless, they're not looking, people in the Occupy movement are not looking, and I would argue should not be looking to the leadership of unions and liberals. They want to appeal to people on the ground. And these people, I think, are very conflicted. People have a variety of perspectives. I also think there's a big difference between unions and liberal groups like Move On, because the way that unions operate, you know, if you're in the workplace where there's a union, you are part of the union and you cannot be kicked out of the union. But of course, something like Move On can decide to kick you out, and there is no real space. It's just cyberspace. It's these lists that they maintain. Also, in terms of unions, what's fundamentally important is this is the point of production. This is where people can actually bring, through collective action, the machinery of capitalism to a halt. Compare that to a group like Move On, and it's just like, what exactly, where are they organizing, who is the agent? You know, with unions, it's workers. With Move On, you don't know really who the agent is. Whenever you sign an online petition that Move On is promoting, you're suddenly a member. You may not even know that you're a member of this group. So there is also very different content and form questions in terms of how people are engaging with these two groups. And I think it's why you see that the Occupy movement is much more interested in engaging with the rank and file union membership than it is necessarily engaging with a lot of people who identify themselves as Move On members. And the benefits are obvious, you know, that you build a much bigger movement, that you can radicalize people. Again, with unions, you can actually create reform movements. Of course, they take many years, often decades, to have a significant change on that particular union. But nonetheless, there are opportunities where you can really radicalize organize people and build a larger movement. The peril is just as great, or perhaps even greater, that all this energy just goes towards electing particular candidates whose interests are not at all aligned with the movement. And I think the best way to sum it up is what these types of movements are principled movements. They have particular principles, and they're not interested in someone's affiliation just because they're wearing a Democrat, a Republican, a Green Party, or whatever pin on their lapel. That doesn't matter. It's we are fighting for the principles. And you know, it may seem absurd to think that we can influence the Republican Party, but if we go back to the 1970s, the type of legislation that Nixon ended up passing on the domestic forefront makes him the last great liberal. You know, this is a guy who passed EPA, Clean Air, Clean Water, Endangered Species Act, OSHA. They actually did have some sort of fair housing program, though, which they basically backtrack on. They did institute some degree of affirmative action. Nixon even had a health care plan that was far better than anything Clinton opposed, you know, and not even talking about Obama's plan that was crafted by the Heritage Institute. So when you change the whole tenor of society, you have a much bigger effect on the political system. So the Occupy Wall Street movement, its principle, it wants to end the tyranny of Wall Street, but the liberals and unions want to shut that energy into a party, the Democratic Party, that is in the pocket of Wall Street. And we only need to go back a few years to the anti-war movement to see the danger of being turned into a partisan movement. People, you know, can Google stuff out about Move On's role. Norman Solomon wrote a lot about this. People like David Swanson, Tom Hayden. And essentially, the argument is that Move On played a really opportunistic role, is what a lot of people in the anti-war movement said then and told me now, that they were interested in climbing on the anti-war movement, not because they were principled in terms of opposing war, whoever was prosecuting those wars, but they were seeking to gain millions of new members, which they did. And yet, while they were gaining all these new members, they were never calling for a full unconditional withdrawal. And when this came to a head in 2007, when the Democrats took over both houses of Congress, after they cynically rode the anti-war movement to power at the last minute, about a month or two before the 2006 election, the Democrats suddenly realized, hey, we can make all these big gains if we start to sound anti-war. And they did. Well, once they got into power in 2007, there was a clamor to just cut the funding. You know, because that's the constitutional process. Congress appropriates the funds. And they could easily cut the funds, and the Pentagon had enough money to bring all the troops home. Instead, they didn't do that, and it was like, oh, we don't need the power of the purse. We'll set a deadline. And that collapsed because Move On played a role. Whether it would have passed, you know, is an open question, but what Move On ended up doing was it ended up essentially thwarting the effort to bring the bill to defund the war before Congress. There were two bills. One was the Pelosi bill, which was about the vague timetable, and then there was, I think it was the Barbara Lee bill, which was about cutting off funding. And it refused to put the Barbara Lee bill for a vote before its membership. And this is the thing about Move On. It likes to present itself as we're very democratic. It's determined by the members. And at the time, the leader of Move On, he said, well, we know it's going to pass, but it's not realistic. So they were subverting their own democratic norm, basically to serve the interests of the Democratic Party. And of course, if we go back to 2007, what happened? All the efforts to end the war collapsed, and there's still U.S. troops, thousands of mercenaries, thousands of spies in Iraq today. And on top of that, we have a president who in 2011 was waging six different wars at once, is asserting the right to the assassination of U.S. citizens without due process, and who is pushing policies with surveillance and indefinite detention.
And so what we have is an anti-Republican war movement, which of course ends totally when when there's no Republican in the White House. And I suppose what we could be looking forward to with an Occupy that seems to be dominated by the Rebuild the Dream and Move Ons is a movement that opposes corporate rule, but says nothing about the President of the United States' deep collaboration with corporate rule.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, like people are like, oh, this is great. Move On is, you know, moving into direct action. And sure, you know, I think any time a group is actually trying to do stuff on the ground, they should be applauded. But, you know, that shouldn't blind us to what is going on. That's why I think it's this nuanced approach that the Occupy movement, you know, it does make sense for it to be engaging with it, reaching out, trying to recruit people, but the point is to deepen their critique, to give them a radical critique. So this 99% spring, for one, it's repackaged events that were determined last summer. This is what the Move On leader told me. He didn't say who, but I'm suspecting it's the unions and liberals decided we're going to do all these corporate shareholder meetings. But not one politician is being targeted. And that is the big warning sign. Because if they said, like, oh, we're going to go after the Republicans, then, of course, people in the Occupy movement, it sounds like, why are we concentrating on the Republicans? The Democrats are just as bad. They're taking all the Wall Street money. They're the ones who haven't prosecuted the bankers. They're the ones who gutted the financial reform. You know, they're the ones who tried to think we're playing this role in trying to gut the new, like, consumer bureau. So, you know, the Democrats are just as complicit. The Obama administration is filled with Goldman Sachs executives. But by not targeting politicians at all, what it does is, you know, it puts the anger on the corporations, and then they're going around saying, oh, Mitt Romney is Mr. 1%. Like, Obama isn't part of the 1%, both in terms of wealth and in terms of his own class interests. But what that does is to say Mitt Romney is Mr. 1%, then implies Obama is for the 99%. And that's the line that Move On is pushing. Justin Rubin told me that this is a real election with real choices, and that you have one candidate who wants to cut taxes to the billionaires, and there's another candidate who wants to tax more fairly. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, there's not one economist in the world, I think, who believes that the Buffett rule, which is what Obama is promoting, would do anything to reduce income inequality. It's just a dog and pony show, essentially. It's basically like we're going to do the absolute minimum possible so we can glom off the Occupy movement. And, you know, what Move On is doing is they're also creating this new movement with Rebuild the Dream called the 99% movement. And then when the election time comes around, you're going to be hearing all this stuff about 99% candidates, 99% voter pledges, never mind that the Occupy movement is completely opposed to partisan politics. Now, there are many people who have said, well, I'm going to vote for Obama, and you know, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for Obama. But what I'm doing the rest of my time is working in the Occupy movement. And I think, again, that is the smarter strategy. If you want to take 5 minutes on election day and go cast a ballot, sure, go ahead and do it. But don't put your energy into this party that is basically been an absolute disaster for working people in America. You need to build an independent force. And one put it very succinctly, we don't need more Democratic Party-aligned advocacy. We need a real resistance movement that can take on the whole system. That's what changed the terms of the debate last fall, and that's what will actually result in dramatic social changes, is building that type of mass movement, not shunting the energy into the Democratic Party.
At a certain level, the co-optation does seem to be far along, at least on the media level. For example, if you watch CNN and other corporate media, you would get the impression that Van Jones, the co-founder of Rebuild the Dream, is a leader of the Occupy movement.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely profoundly cynical on his part. The fact that he does present himself as a leader of the Occupy movement, she has, and had nothing to do with it, that speaks volumes. The fact that back in October of 2011, they had this Take Back the American Dream conference that, you know, of course, the group he founded convened. And at that conference, they announced they're going to run 2000 Rebuild the Dream candidates in 2012 in October. 1 month later, he's on CNN saying, we're going to run thousands of 99% candidates in 2012. And I was like, wow, that is just an act of such cynicism that you are just totally rebranding these candidates, trying to co-opt the ideas and language of this movement that you actually have no interest in pursuing what their politics are actually about, which is that we need a fundamental restructuring of the system. Van Jones is all about getting Obama reelected in 2012. And again, if people want to vote for him, it's just like, yes, this is the nature of the system, that Romney would be probably more disastrous than Obama. But you're not going to change anything by working to reelect Obama. Let the liberals do this. What I think, you know, the left and the radicals should be doing is building, spending all their energy on building this independent mass movement. But they need to be aware of how Rebuild the Dream and Move On is using the energy of the Occupy movement to build a 99% movement brand that they are then going to use to promote the 99% candidates and the 99% voter pledge. And people should Google up the 99% voter pledge. Justin Rubin told me that was based in part on the Contract for the American Dream and Occupy Wall Street. And by that, I'm assuming he meant the Occupy Wall Street Declaration. But if you look at the voter pledge, it is so weak and so vague. Things like good jobs now and tax more fairly and support people, not corporations. That one, it sounds like Obama's talking points, but Mitt Romney could probably agree with it, right? And so you're taking this radical essence and just turning it into absolute political mush that can be used to support the Democratic Party. And so that's what I think the real danger is. You know, again, you know, I think a lot of people do want to engage with the unions, especially the rank and file and liberals on the ground. But, you know, they need to understand what the dangers are and what the possibilities are, because I think there could be big benefits for the movement if they can bring in a lot of people and get them to adopt a radical analysis and an understanding why there has to be fundamental changes, not just this, you know, little tinkering around the edges.
Arun Gupta covers the Occupy movement for Salon Magazine.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor was recently convicted of crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. Dr. Gerald Horn has written extensively on human rights. He's a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Dr. Horn appeared on this Sunday morning live show with Norman Richman on Radio Regent in Toronto, Canada.
I'm not going to address the question of whether or not Charles Taylor was guilty, although it is striking that since Hitler's successor was convicted in Nuremberg after World War II, that he's the first head of state to be convicted for such heinous crimes. And think of what's happened over the last 60, 70 years since the conclusion of World War II. My beef with the International Criminal Court is the one-sided nature of the International Criminal Court. They seem to have a proclivity for indicting Africans or a handful of Europeans who were once involved with socialist regimes, like Slobodan Milosevic of Serbia, former Yugoslavia. Tony Blair? No. George W. Bush? No. It's only Africans, for the most part, and a stray European who was had the bad wisdom to be associated with the socialist regime. It seems to me that this is self-discrediting. And not only that, but you may recall that when Charles Taylor stepped down from office in Liberia, he had cut a deal where in return for leaving power, he was supposed to get exiled in Nigeria. And Thabo Mbeki, the former leader of South Africa who helped to negotiate that deal, was really irate when, of course, Mr. Taylor was arrested trying to flee Nigeria after George W. Bush turned the tables on him and said, no, that deal is off. And Thabo Mbeki predicted, as did many others, that it would provide no incentive for any leader to leave power on the premise that they could escape prosecution, because the deals won't hold up. And so it almost guarantees more bloodshed. It reminds me, quite frankly, of this disastrous intervention in Libya in 2011, which was supposedly an illustration of the so-called responsibility to protect doctrine, that is to say that a regime or a leader is not allowed under international law to butcher one's people, that the international community is supposed to intervene, and that was the rationale for intervening in Libya, except that there is now all these questions raised about whether people were actually being butchered in Libya to the degree that we were told in 2011. In fact, to the degree that some of our progressive radio stations and TV radio programs were telling us in 2011. And now the responsibility to protect doctrine is in shreds. And I might also add parenthetically that an outgrowth of this catastrophe in Libya is now the splitting of Mali in two. That is to say that many of the fighters who were fighting in Libya then fled to Mali, where they then split the nation in two. And, of course, it's given a shot in the arm to Boko Haram in Nigeria, which of late in the past few days has been attacking journalists and attacking the offices and newspapers. All of this is a direct outgrowth of this Libyan debacle, many progressives so-called supported. And so likewise, I think that the International Criminal Court, its reputation is in shreds. It should not be given any sort of credibility until it corrects its record and brings an indictment, for example, against George W. Bush, who went against the United Nations mandate in the spring of 2003 and invaded a member state of the United Nations, speaking of Iraq, leading to the massacre of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of individuals, a direct violation of international law, and yet he's living in comfortable retirement in Texas, giving speeches at the tune of six figures a pop. So this is why I have such a strong objection to what happened to Mr. Taylor, not because I'm pleading for his innocence. I'm not going there. But just the double standards and the duplicity that's discrediting the international community and institutions like the International Criminal Court.
And that's it for this week's edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.